You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Friday to you, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a heads up today, of course, it's Friday. It's time for our national town hall meeting with the man I think of as America's senator. Although the good citizens of Vermont, I was one for a decade, know that he's theirs, Senator Bernie Sanders. But first, just a quick programming note. This is the last week that we will. Many of you are listening to us time delayed. You're hearing us at 3 o'clock Eastern time or noon Pacific time. And we will be live with Bernie next week at 3 o'clock Eastern time, noon Pacific time. If you're listening to us time delayed, you'll simply be hearing us live and you'll be able to call in. And if you're listening to us right now in the noontime and live or 9 a.m. Pacific time on virtually all of our stations, they will be moving us back, to the 3 o'clock time so that you'll be able to call in. So a whole lot more people will be able to call in, which is a great thing. Senator Sanders, welcome to the show.
So, Tom, what I want to ask you, do we change the name of the program to Late Afternoon Snack with Bernie? Or?
Well, on the West Coast, it's lunchtime.
It's brunch. All right. So we can have a brunch.
We can still call it brunch or we could call it lunch. But I like brunch with Bernie, and I like the double Bs. So what's going on in the Senate, and what are you working on right now, Senator?
Incredibly busy time. Sometimes I walk in there on Monday night, and the next thing I know, I'm on a plane back home on Thursday night or Friday. Let me just touch on some of the issues that we have been involved in. I am very, very proud that on Tuesday, which is town meeting day in the state of Vermont, that's when all the towns get together and deal with their municipal budgets, their school budgets, et cetera, et cetera. We had 64 towns in the state voting to tell the United States Congress that we need a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, that disastrous Supreme Court decision, which is now allowing corporations and billionaires to pump huge amounts of money into the political process. We have two states, New Mexico and Hawaii, whose legislatures have already voted on this issue. So what we're seeing, I think, at the grassroots level is that the American people are saying, excuse me, corporations are not people. We do not want to evolve to a situation where a handful of billionaires are determining who gets elected in the United States of America. I see this Citizens United case is just absolutely horrendous in terms of the future of American democracy. I've got a constitutional amendment in to overturn it. Others do as well. And this is an issue we have to stay focused on. But bottom line is Vermont has spoken out on this issue, and I hope the rest of the country follows us. Another issue that's obviously on everybody's mind, especially those people who are driving right now, is the high price of gasoline. And here's the key point that I want to make on this. So we've been working hard. We sent a letter to the chairman of an agency called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Right now, the evidence is overwhelming. I don't think anyone disputes it anymore, that one of the reasons that gas prices are soaring has nothing to do with supply and demand. Supply today, Tom, is higher than it was 3 years ago when gas was $1.90 a gallon. Demand is lower than any time since 1997. And what I think many economists, the St. Louis Fed, many others now acknowledge is one of the major reasons that gas prices are spiking is because of the speculation of Wall Street firms on the oil futures market.
The banksters are locking it up.
They're doing it again. So, on one hand, you got, of course, the oil companies, Exxon Mobil, and those guys making $1 trillion in profit in the last 10 years. They're ripping off the consumers. And then, that's not enough. You have the Wall Street guys, Goldman Sachs leading the pack, dominating the oil futures market, driving prices up. Interestingly enough, according to McClatchy, an article on February 21st, U.S. demand for oil and refined products, including gasoline, is down sharply from last year, so much that the United States has actually become a net exporter of gasoline, unable to consume all that it makes. We're exporting gasoline, and yet prices are soaring. And I think what this article, and I think most people understand, this has to do with speculation. Now, here's the point. As part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill, what the Congress told the Commodity Futures Trading Commission is you got to deal with this issue. You have to end excessive speculation on the oil futures market. You got to do it by January 2011. Well, last that I heard, we're in March 2012, and guess what? They have not done that yet. So I will be talking actually later this afternoon to Chairman Gensler, and we're just developing. These guys have got to obey the law is what it's about. And they got to start putting what we call position limits. Limit the amount that any company can control on the oil futures market, and economists tell us that will drive gas and oil prices down. So that's an issue that we're paying a lot of attention to. There's another issue out there that does not get much attention, but I think it's awfully important. I held a hearing on this as chairman of the subcommittee on primary care, and that is the dental crisis in America. You know, we often talk about the health crisis. We don't pay attention to the fact that 130 million Americans have no dental insurance at all. Many, many millions of people are suffering with dental pain.
They
just can't afford to walk into a dentist's office because the cost of dental care is so very expensive. On top of that, we are seeing more dentists retire than are graduating dental school. So we have a crisis in number of dentists that we have. And then even with the dentists we have, many of them are simply not treating low and moderate income people. They're into, you know, cosmetic dentistry. So how we create a situation where people get the dental care they need, and dental care is more than a pretty smile. What dental care is about is a health issue. If you're not digesting your food properly, you're going to have health problems. Poor teeth can result in infection and serious health problems as well. So it's an issue that we are focusing on. We had a very interesting hearing on this a couple of weeks ago in Washington. We're going to have a public meeting on that in Vermont tomorrow, actually.
Okay.
Another area that I think we're making a little bit of progress is I perceive that the consciousness in this country is growing about the decline of manufacturing and the difficulty it is for many of us to buy products made in America. And this is a huge issue. We have lost some 60,000 factories in the last 10 years. More and more of the products that we consume come from China and other countries. And I think people understand that unless we're building the products, manufacturing the products that we consume, you're not going to have a strong economy. I have been working with a number of government agencies, and we're going to expand that. We're working with the Smithsonian. We're working with the agency that supplies products to the national parks and monuments. And now we're working with the Veterans Administration. And as I mentioned last week, I learned about that problem right on this program, Tom. A woman veteran called us up a couple of months ago. We investigated it. She was right. And right now within the VA, we're trying to make sure that the products they sell in their hospitals are made in America. And we're going to expand that into other areas as well. But there is a growing consciousness about the need to buy American, the need to have legislation passed, which says that when we do work, that to as great a degree as possible, those products are made in America, and we create jobs here in this country.
That's great. That harkens back to the 1935 Buy American Act that Franklin
That's
Roosevelt
right.
passed, that government spending has to go for American goods first. And
right, and Senator, I believe Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio is going to be introducing that language again in terms of the transportation bill. A lot of product is used in the transportation bill, obviously, which, by the way, is another important piece of legislation we're dealing with right now. We hope that at a time when the Senate has been fairly dysfunctional and not getting anything done because of Republican obstructionism, we hope and believe that next week we're going to pass a transportation bill which is $109 billion to start rebuilding our roads and bridges and rail. This is not enough money. In fact, it's a fairly modest proposal given the enormous infrastructural needs that this country faces, but it will do a couple of things. It will rebuild our crumbling infrastructure and also create a significant number of new jobs. So that's a positive sign, I think, in the midst of a fairly dysfunctional Congress.
Yeah, and let's hope we can get it through. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Because over at Bernie's website, you can find his petition to, or his, constitutional amendment to repeal Citizens United, to overturn it, basically, and sign up for the Bernie Buzz.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
Tax the rich, feed the poor, tell Rarano, rich no more.
Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, and Linda in Barrie, Vermont, who listens to WDEV, and we will be live on WDEV next Friday as well. Linda, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. How are you?
Good, Linda.
And hello, Tom.
Hello.
My question is, why are pharmaceutical manufacturers not making enough medication for everyone?
That is
a
very good question.
I understand this is a big problem.
It is a big problem.
And I'm running into it here in central Vermont.
Are you? Yeah. We are working on that issue, and I think there have been some breakthroughs. What Linda is talking about, folks, is an unbelievable as it may sound. There are life and death cancer drugs and other important drugs that hospitals and doctors are now finding it very difficult to come by. And I think what ends up happening is, I understand it, Linda, there is not enough, you know, these are specific drugs, and the companies, I gather, don't think they could make as much money as they would want compared to other products that they're selling or whatever. But there is legislation to begin to address that issue, and I think we are beginning to make a little bit of progress. But the idea, can you imagine being on a drug therapy if you have cancer, and the doctor, you know, tells you, I'm sorry, we can't continue that because we don't have access to that drug anymore. So Linda points to a very important issue that we are working on.
Don in Harrington, Delaware. Hey, Don, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, I'm a letter carrier, and the word out there is that because both sides are for this transportation bill, Darrell Issa is going to slip a amendment in there to hurt the Postal Service, and Speaker Boehner is not sure yet if he's going to let him slip that in there. Can you do like a Senator Jesse Helms and not let that bill go through? That FAA bill that you guys all voted for hurt the railroad and the flight attendants unions because everybody passed it and didn't read that bill. Can you help us out?
Well, Don, and we are leading the effort on this effort. So we are working very hard with all of the postal unions. And right now, you know, what we are trying to do literally is prevent the shutting down of 3,700 rural post offices and half of the processing plants in this country and slowing down mail delivery service. So to answer your question, what we have in the House is ISA, who has introduced legislation that would be absolutely horrendous. So, and the answer to your question is obviously we will do everything we can to defeat proposals that will hurt postal workers or the U.S. Postal Service.
Peter in Albany, New York, watching us on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you very much. Senator Sanders, I had a thought. Why not have the Social Security Administration issue a photo ID to satisfy voting right laws? And also you can maybe have them get it at the post office, could be issuing them along with the Social Security Administration. And the other thing I wanted to say was, for the people of Vermont and the Northeast, plastic windows will cut your heat bill in half. For about $1 a window, you can cut your heat bill in half. I've done it 5 years in a row, and I'll hang up and get your answer. But I like you both, and keep up the good work.
Well, let me, Peter, in terms of the photo IDs, that may or may not be a good idea. But what I will tell you is that what Republican governors and legislatures are doing all across this country is very clearly an effort toward voter suppression. It is no secret. Everybody knows exactly what's going on. You tell the old, low-income people, people who don't have automobiles, people don't have good transportation access. You're saying to them is, if you want to vote, you're going to have to show us a photo ID. And even if you don't own a car and if you don't drive, well, that's tough luck. Yeah, I guess you can go to the other side of town and wait online and get your photo taken, and maybe it only cost you X amount of dollars. And I think that that's a disaster, because the whole argument for that is that voter fraud is this terrible, terrible problem in America. We got to protect the democratic process and against voter fraud. The answer is, everything that I have read is that voter fraud is, thank God, in this country not a significant problem. Obviously, when it appears, it should be punished very seriously. But I think using the argument of voter fraud, what many of these right-wing legislatures and governors are doing is simply trying to suppress the vote. And it's kind of, as I see it, the other half of Citizens United. You make it harder for low-income people, minorities, older people to vote. And then on the other hand, you open up the opportunity for billionaires and corporations to spend as much money as they want. And that's kind of what the Republican two-pronged attack is against the democratic process. In terms of plastic windows, I know about plastic windows. Used to have them 30 years ago when I lived up in the northern part of our state. They do work. But better than that, what we're trying to do now is in Vermont and around the country stress and invest in weatherization. One of the areas and one of the ways that we can make huge progress in this country in transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel is through energy efficiency, is through weatherization. And there are right now in the state of Vermont, and many states I suspect, people have seen their fuel bills go down by 20, 30, 40, 50% because they're finally adequately weatherizing their homes. That's something we should be investing in, and we are beginning to make some progress there.
Is that a specific standalone piece of legislation, or was that something that would be attached to something else?
Well, we're working in it a number of ways. Bob Menendez of New Jersey and I passed legislation which put billions of dollars into doing just that. And there are other pieces of legislation as well.
That is great. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, 866-97-THOM. Our telephone number, Senator Sanders, website, sanders.senate.gov. You can see and sign the petition for his amendment to the Constitution to roll back Citizens United over there. Plus, a lot of great news, and you can sign up for his newsletter.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And at TomHartman.com, you can drop into our free live chat room. You can post your own blogs. You can participate in our message boards. It's all free and fun.
We will continue to work for better and cheaper transportation, for low interest rates, for sounder home financing. And, my friends, for all of these, we have only just begun to fight.
Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. A phrase I borrowed from Senator Sanders back 7 years ago or so.
It's my intellectual property rights.
I owe you a nickel every time I use it. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us in our national town hall meeting here. Dave in Orange County, California, listening on K-Talk in Los Angeles. You're on the air with Senator Sanders, Dave.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Dave.
I'm a gay married man in the state of California. I got married in between the state Supreme Court decision back in 08 and the awful Prop 8 election. I was wondering if, Senator Sanders, if you were aware that the IRS has changed its internal rules handling domestic partners and gay married couples, in that we are now required to combine our incomes for reporting purposes. We file as single. It's a very convoluted thing. But both my husband and I are self-employed, and so we pay the Social Security tax, the self-employment tax. My question is, this means we cannot get Social Security survivor benefits, yet we are it's insisted that we combine our incomes for the purposes of Social Security.
Actually, Dave, that's an issue I am not aware of, and it's an interesting issue. You are being treated differently than a heterosexual married couple?
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly. We have to check the single box on the 1040, but we have to report both of our incomes and our withholding our quarterly payments together and combine them for purposes of computing.
Dave, might this have to do with the federal DOMA law, the Defense of Marriage Act?
I don't think it does directly.
I suspect it
seems to conflict with DOMA.
Let me give my office a ring on that, Dave.
I beg your pardon?
Give my office a ring on that.
Oh, okay, very good. But
let me see what we can find out about that.
Okay.
It seems to me it would be an opening for either litigation or legislation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you,
Dave. Thank you very much. Ryan in Delray Beach, Florida, watching on Free Speech TV. Ryan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Good afternoon, Sanders. My question is, why can't every currency on the planet or and anyone that has a currency be valued all the same and use simple denominations similar to what we have. I understand how our currency a little bit is valued, but I mean, as you guys say yourself and on freedom of speech, like it's not a sustainable way.
Well, Ryan, I think the answer to that is that you have many, many countries around the world who, sustain their own currencies in their own way, and I don't think we're close to having a one-world currency, so I don't think that's going to happen.
Sharon in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Yeah. With the voter suppression that's going on, it seems like we keep hearing the bad news about it, like this veteran who just was unable to vote. What I'm wondering is, can Congress, can the U.S. Congress, the Senate and the House, whether they would do it or not, but have any way of stopping and slowing this down? Because I don't see much happening to actually stop it. And the only other thing is, I am an optician, and ocular health and vision, especially for kids who are poor, is extremely important, along with dental. And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. We have talked to the Attorney General's office and have asked them to be more vigorous in taking on these voter suppression laws, which to me are unconstitutional and clearly are very, very political. And they are doing some of that, but I don't think that issue has risen to the level in the Attorney General's office that it should have. I should also tell you that my office has asked the General Accountability Office to do a study about how significant the so-called voter fraud is and the implication of these voter suppression laws, because I think we want to take away any pretense that any of these folks have that they are acting for any legitimate reason. Voter fraud is a serious business. People who knew voter fraud should be severely punished. It virtually, thank God, in this country does not exist. So we have asked the GAO to study that issue. The question is, can legislation be forthcoming? The answer, perhaps. But this is a huge issue. We're looking to the White House for some leadership here, but it is an issue that we have got to focus on.
Mike in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening to iHeartRadio. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon. It's an honor to speak with you both. My question has to do with gas prices. When I've got an app on my phone that shows me exactly what oil does every day, and I want to know, why is it that when it goes up a dollar to a barrel, the next day it goes up at the pump, but when it goes down a dollar to a barrel, it seems to take a week or two to make it to the pump?
Hey, Mike, you're absolutely right. I think we have noticed that for many, many years. Look, as I mentioned earlier, when we talk about gas and oil prices, you're dealing with two of the most powerful political and economic forces in this country. You're dealing with the oil companies, ExxonMobil, who in the past has made more money in a given year than any other company in the history of humanity, and other oil companies have also made huge profits. And then on the other hand, now we're dealing with the speculators from Wall Street who control the oil futures market. So you're absolutely right. I have noticed that. I think many Americans have noticed that. When the price of a barrel of oil goes up, gas prices go right up, price goes down, suddenly there's a significant lag in lowering the prices. So we're just dealing with real concentration of ownership issues, and it's causing severe problems for the American people. As I said earlier, we are focusing on the issue of speculation, demanding that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission do what they are supposed to do and end and break up this excessive concentration of ownership on the oil futures market.
Kathy in Etna, Wyoming, watching us on Dish TV or Direct TV on Free Speech TV. Kathy, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thank you. My question is, yesterday morning, I think it was either yesterday morning or the day before, RT News had a brief snippet stating that RCIA in Blackwater Blackwater's called Academy, is in home Syria, and I'm wondering why Blackwater is in Syria.
Well, Kathy, I think that's a very good question, and I don't know the answer. What I do know
is that recently, last week it was, Secretary of Defense Panetta came before the Budget Committee, and some of us asked him about the general issue of contracting out. And, you know, it's funny, Tom, when we talk about the number of people who serve in the military, we often refer to those people who are in, you know, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, and so forth. Mm-hmm. The truth is there are more people under contract service than there are who actually work for the U.S. government.
Wow.
And it's hard to know exactly what that number is, but it may well be in the millions. I think the Department of Defense is now beginning to try to determine the economics of that, which might suggest that in many instances we are spending a whole lot of money, more money than we should. I'll never forget, I was in Afghanistan a couple of years ago, and we were being driven around, some of us in the Senate were being driven around in an armored car in Kabul, and there were two guys in front, you know, with their guns, and one guy was in the military and one guy was a contractor doing the same exact work, and one was being paid a hell of a lot more than the other.
Jim in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, good morning, Senator. I have a question about energy. I totally support clean energy, obviously solar, wind, and if we can get 100% that's fine. But I don't think it's a good decision to push the market towards it while killing the oil industry, oil drilling, while the reality is that we still need oil. I mean, for example, you know, internet went up, magazine sales go down, but it went gradually with a business sense. We don't kill the magazine because we were planning on developing the internet. So why not do these things concurrently and gradually let the market move itself out of the oil into clean rather than shut this down, do this, because it doesn't make financial sense?
Jim, I don't think anyone is shutting down the oil industry. Everybody knows that the transition away from fossil fuel is not going to happen overnight. But I think what some of us are concerned about is that when you have oil companies like ExxonMobil making huge profits and in some years paying nothing in federal income tax, and that's true for other companies as well, that's absurd. These guys don't need huge tax breaks when they're making incredible profits. And we're also concerned, obviously, and also about the impacts of global warming, which some of my Republican friends deny, but clearly is having a huge impact on the planet today and will have an only worse impact in years to come. So nobody, Jim, I think, is talking about or suggesting, because you can't do it, shutting down the oil industry. But we are suggesting that they don't need any more subsidies or tax breaks, and that we have got to focus on transforming the industry away from fossil fuel to sustainable energy and energy efficiency.
Lunch with Bernie, 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can, a great news site that's updated very, very frequently is Sanders.Senate.gov. You can also sign up for Bernie's newsletter there. Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here with big news. We're moving! Starting next week, the Tom Hartman Program will be live 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's noon to 3 Pacific Time.
Lost working time is lost money. Every day that a workman is unemployed, or a machine is unused, or a business organization is marking time, it is a loss to the nation. Don't give up, we've
got a reason to live. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Laura in Los Angeles watching on Senator Sanders' website on sanders.senate.gov.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I'm a huge admirer of yours, and I'm calling today about the post office, and I really have appreciated your leadership in this area, and I wanted to know if there was anything else that we could do right now as citizens to support saving the post office, support its innovation for the future. Thank you.
Laura, thanks very much. I'll tell you, I've been amazed at how much interest people have about the need to save the post office. Just yesterday, I will tell you, in the Democratic caucus, Senate caucus, we had the Postmaster General Donahue there to answer some hard and tough questions. Laura, what I would urge you to do, please call up your member of Congress and your senators and tell them that you think it's important that we not shut down post offices all over this country, slow mail delivery service, and lay off or shrink the workforce there by hundreds of thousands of American workers. There are ways that we can make the post office more innovative, more entrepreneurial. They can bring in more revenue. They can respond to the digital age. The world has changed. The post office has got to change as well. But I think we can do it in a way other than just cutting, cutting, cutting. So to answer your question, Laura, we're making some progress. There's a lot of discussion going on. Don't know what the end results will be. But more and more people in Congress and around the country are determined not to allow the post office to be savaged.
Jeffrey in Framingham, Mass. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, I'm Jeffrey. My question is regarding Social Security. The question is, when applying for welfare benefits, if you're a Social Security recipient, why is it that they include that income as if it were earned income or a salary?
Because it's income. I mean, you know, because they want to make sure that people who receive those benefits need them, and they have to calculate all of the income that people receive.
Jeff in Phoenix, listening on AM 1480. Hey, Jeff, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Bernie. I'd like to know, what do you think? Would sortition of legislators based on our national census end polarization and corruption in Congress?
You're talking about appointing?
I missed
correct,
that point.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. Jeff, how would that work? What are you talking about?
Well, you understand sortition. I talked with you about this a couple weeks
sortation.
Ago.
Sortation, okay.
The lottery picking.
Yeah,
the
so you're saying people serve in Congress the same way that you get jury duty right now.
Instead of elections, which is the problem between
right.
the whole
but
thing.
This is the way the Greeks did it back in the day. Bernie, your thoughts?
Well, I think I'll serve with the elections system that we have right now.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we do have one good word left over from that, Bernie. If you didn't show up, you know, they had 6,000 people every year, and there was a lottery for it. And if your name was called and you didn't show up, you were called an idiota.
I mean, it's interesting, and it's important to learn. But I think for the foreseeable future, we are going to be continuing the election system that we have right now.
Yeah, we have this thing called the Constitution too. Kelly in Seattle, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, sir. My question to you today is concerning taxes. I, as a person that has never earned more than $25,000 a year, I feel like it's unfair for us to ask rich people to pay more than us poor people. And I feel like there should just be a flat tax where we all pay the same amount. So what I was thinking was, what are your thoughts on a flat tax based on 10% net worth instead of 10% income?
All right. Well, Kelly, you raised, let me just say this. In terms of the flat income tax, which is not what you're asking, I think that that is extremely regressive. I think that in our country, we have seen the wealthiest people become very much wealthier. We have seen their effective tax rate, going to the lowest point that has been in decades, which is what folks like Warren Buffett are talking about. So I think we should have progressive income tax. I think we should do away with a lot of the tax breaks that now benefit in terms of dividend benefits, lower rates on dividends and so forth. You're raising another issue, and that is a tax on wealth, which is a very interesting approach, something that I have thought about for a number of years. I can tell you that it's not going to happen tomorrow, but it is something certainly that we should pursue. The other issues that we are looking at in terms of raising revenue for the government as a transaction fee on Wall Street. A whole lot of stocks are going bought and sold every day, and I think a transaction fee could bring in substantial income and damp a speculation as well. So you raise an interesting question. I disagree with the concept of a flat tax on income. That's regressive. It benefits upper-income people. The idea of a tax on wealth is interesting. There are other ways that we can go forward to bring in more revenue to the federal government in a way which addresses the reality that we have the most unequal distribution of income and wealth of any major country on this planet.
Bernie, just a minute left for the show. Not enough time to take a call. Your final thoughts?
A lot's happening in Washington. I think The bad news is we are seeing now the naked power of corporate America and big money in terms of their willingness and ability to spend unbelievable sums of money in campaigns as a result of Citizens United. And by the way, it is only going to get worse. My hope is, I should tell you, that while we're focusing on a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, that we can pass legislation which can diminish the impact of Citizens United, and that we can do that fairly quickly. For example, if you force the CEOs of the corporations who are putting these ads on the air to have their picture on the ad and say what any candidate has to say, they approve that ad, it will go a long way to significantly reduce the amount of ads that we see. So there's a lot that has to be done. The good news, I think, American people are catching on as to the reactionary nature of the Republican agenda.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you.
And we'll see you next week at 3 Eastern
time.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Check out his website. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. It's Anything Goes Friday today, and I want there's a bunch of things in the news that we will get to as we continue through the program, but I wanted to share with you my Anything Goes, my existential crisis I experienced yesterday, and I'm curious even if this is the sort of thing that has ever happened to you, and if so, how you dealt with it. Living here in Washington, D.C., there are a lot of people on street corners asking for money. And I remember before we lived in D.C., years and years ago, back when we were living in Atlanta, Louise and I went to India together. And you walk out of the hotel, and instantly there'd be 30 kids following you wherever you went with their hands out. And we were, you know, with a relief organization, and one of the local Indians that we were with the relief organization said, don't give money to the kids because there are actual programs in Mumbai and Bombay at that time for them, and it just basically, you know, rewards the behavior of standing in front of the hotel and creating a problem. That you know, there's an internal struggle with me about that, and always has been. And I was really pleased some months ago when we had on a fellow from Street Sense, which is the local homeless newspaper here in D.C., and they're all over the country, and some of them have different names. Most of them are called Street Sense, though it's kind of a franchise. And they actually vet homeless people to determine that they're actually, you know, more real homeless people and really trying to work their way out of poverty and not just somebody trying to get a little extra money for some booze this week. And they have, you know, an ID that they wear and all this kind of stuff. And so instead of giving money to the guy standing in front of my apartment building when I walk out, or the person standing in front of the CVS when I walk into it, I've been buying street senses, and I just pull out whatever the top bill I have is, and so sometimes I buy one for a dollar and sometimes I buy one for 20. And in addition to the, you know, the normal charitable giving that we do, but I've always struggled with this issue of how do you deal with this? Yesterday, in the third hour of our program, we had on a self-proclaimed Christian expert on Christianity who wanted to basically kick around Mormonism. And, you know, setting aside the issue of all of that, I mean, I asked him the question of, you know, who made you the Pope, basically, the arbiter of what is or isn't Christianity. But, I don't think he had a particularly good answer for that, but I made the point that, in my opinion, that somebody could claim to be a Christian or, frankly, any religion, because they all share the same values, if they held to the values that were laid out in, for example, Matthew 25 or the Sermon on the Mount, which is feed the hungry, clothe the naked or house the homeless, visit those unjustly in prison, heal the sick. So anyhow, we talked about that for an hour, you and I, and a lot of people called in, and we talked about Mormonism and Christianity and all these other things. I left here, when I got off the air, And I walked down to Union Station to grab the train, and I usually grab something to eat there and take it with me over to the RT studios where we put together our TV show in the evening. And I went into and I walked into, I think it's pronounced Chipotle or however you say it. This Chipotle, thank you, Jacob. This Mexican fast food restaurant in Union Station. And there was a woman who was clearly mentally ill. You know, the rocking, the kind of tics, and as I walked in, she singled me out from all the people in there and said, "Sir, sir," and I just kept on walking. I didn't want to engage. I was actually intimidated by it, you know, at a certain level when somebody confronts you and they appear to be mentally ill. And she called my name out a half a dozen times, and I just, not my name, just calling me sir. And I walked up to the counter, and I said, you know, I'll take a corn enchilada and just give me the vegetables. And, you know, and I ordered. And so she came up to the counter next to me and stopped asking, trying to get my attention, and started ordering food. And it occurred to me that it suddenly hit me that she was going to ask me, and now I'm projecting here, I might be wrong, but that she was going to ask me to buy her food. And I've often, I mean, I actually had this experience once. I've you see people who have signs that say, need food, please contribute. You know, they're standing on the freeway off ramp or something. And this must have been 6 or 8 years ago. I was literally walking out of a fast food restaurant with a bag of something. I forget what it was. My recollection is that it was out of a KFC, and I had a bag with corn on the cob and mashed potatoes in it or something. And a homeless person said, you got any spare change? And I said, no, but you can have my meal. And he grabbed it out of my hands and threw it at me and started screaming at me that I was, you know, being demeaning toward him and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I kind of got it. This is a guy who wanted to go buy a bottle of wine or something, but or he was another mentally ill person. So anyhow, I get to the end of the line, and as I'm handing my credit card, and this woman next to me is still debating with the clerk, you know, which kind of thing she wants on her tortillas or tacos, it just occurred to me I should say to the person when I was checking out, you know, put her meal on mine too. I mean, she was obviously homeless or something close to it. You know, she was a mess and mentally ill as well, as far as I could tell. And then I thought, but then if I do that, I might, you know, it might engage her, and then I'm that might, you know, and so I didn't. And as I was walking out, and then, you know, I left, and she was next up to the counter, although her food hadn't been made up, so I didn't hear what her interchange was, but I saw the people who were making her taco looking at each other with this look of, uh-oh, it's her, kind of, you know, or what's going on here or something, because she'd been, you know, shouting sir at me. So anyhow, I walked out, and as I was walking out, as I got outside the building, this voice in my head, and I'm sure it was my own unconscious, my own, you know, my own voice, because I'd been saying it on the air, but I just heard this voice say, I was hungry and you did not feed me. And it just stopped me. And I just, you know, this feeling of kind of dread went over me, like I had just failed a test. And so I turned around and I walked back, thinking that if she still hadn't checked out, I would walk up and offer my credit card, offer to pay, you know, it was $6 or something, but offer to pay for it. And when I got to the door, it's a glass door, I could see inside the door, and she was already over putting napkins and forks in her bag very, very carefully and very methodically. And so I thought, okay, either they gave her the meal for free, or she had money and she was yelling sir at me for something else. And so I turned around and left. But I just, it shook me for hours. And when I got out of the subway station at the other stop at where I was going, the first thing I saw was somebody selling street scents. And so I bought a street scents. But it was You know, for most of the day, I just couldn't get it out of my head. In fact, I still can't. That's why I'm talking about it right now. This existential crisis that I think we as Americans have, I think all humans have. How do we deal with poverty when it confronts us, or mental illness, when it confronts us face-to-face, or hunger? Now, you know, it's very easy to go on the radio and say, oh, well, you know, we should have food stamps for everybody, and we need to expand the food stamp program. In fact, the food stamp program has lifted millions of people out of poverty, or allowed poverty to be sufferable for them. But what do you do when it's in your face? Looking back on this, I genuinely feel like I failed. And, I guess that's that. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, anything you want to talk about, the board is already solidly lit up. We'll be taking your calls. I don't think it goes Friday here right after this. Anything goes Friday, whatever you'd like to talk about. Andy in Seattle. Hey, Andy, what's on your mind today?
Well, I started out listening to the discussion about the street people, and I share the same apprehensions or uncertainties. And, I'm sure like you, we lay awake at night listening, thinking about things, you know, to whom much has been given and all that stuff. But yeah. I tend to be wary of being taken advantage of. So we just give to the food bank, the services for the blind. My son works at the men's shelter here in Seattle, which I believe is a Catholic organization. And then I've got a few street people that hang around my restaurant quite a bit, but they're polite enough to come after hours. They don't come into the restaurant when they have customers, and so I feed them that way, and we do our little bit that way.
That's nice. So you've found a comfort zone where, but I'm curious, how would you have reacted in the situation that I was in, where you're actually walking into a restaurant and somebody's saying, would you please buy me a meal here? And it's never, a $6 meal.
It's tough. It's very difficult. And I've had two instances where somebody said, you know, I need money for food. And I said, okay, let's go down here and I'll buy you a sandwich. And they didn't take me up on it. So yeah. I felt like I was, you know, you never know when somebody's just trying to, use you. So.
Well, there's the fact of the matter is that a lot of homeless people are mentally ill, and also a lot of them are drug addicts or alcoholics, and so they don't want the money. I mean, obviously the food is a good thing, but there's a soup kitchen down the road. What they really want the money for is a bottle of wine. Some of them, and it's like, you know, how do we make that kind of parsing? But when you're walking into a restaurant and somebody says, you know, will you buy me a meal? That's why I feel like I failed that test, and that's. Right. Andy, thank you for your thoughts, and thank you for your comments, and for sharing your story, and for feeding homeless people from your restaurant. That's brilliant. Lynn in South Miami, Florida. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I just wanted to tell you, I've been in the same situation you have. I had apartment houses. I used to rent rooms very cheaply to different organizations in South Miami, Florida. And I used to give money to people, and I used to follow them. And then all of a sudden, I follow them going to the drug dealer or to the bar. I've had food thrown in my face. And I don't want you to feel bad. And the only reason I called is because when you specified that you turned around and you saw this particular person taking her plastic utensils and orderly putting them in a certain way. And there's so many mentally ill people, and just don't feel bad, because I used to feel terrible about it, and I'm really not qualified to deal with mentally ill people, but I tried as little as and best I could.
Yeah. Well, she
and
was.
I used to give Christmas parties for people on the street, and I got to a point I couldn't do it. I just.
Yeah. In the world of charity, and I've worked in that world for years, it's called donor burnout, or donor fatigue, and people see enough, the old Sally Struthers ads, enough starving kids on TV, and there's a certain point where they just kind of turn off. One final thought that I want to share about this story of what I experienced is when I looked back and this woman was measuring one plastic fork against the other, trying to decide which to put in her bag, is what it looked like to me. And it occurred to me perhaps she was schizophrenic. And then it occurred to me, I remembered a brilliant research paper, and a couple of them, actually. Terrence McKenna published one, and I believe Steve Larson had written something about this, about how schizophrenia might actually be an adaptive thing and have a purpose, just like I've hypothesized that ADHD does. And the way it has an adaptive function is that in indigenous and aboriginal societies, typically the shamans are schizophrenic. And my experience interacting with schizophrenic people throughout my life, and the first one that I knew was when I was probably 16 or 17 years old, is that you can't fool a schizophrenic. You can't lie to a schizophrenic. Schizophrenics are like birds. You know, they absolutely know what's going on inside your head the minute, you know, they're like people who are on acid. You know, I mean, they just absolutely see right through you. And then as I was walking away, I was thinking, not only did I blow it, but I blew it. I was being called out by a shaman. You know, it's like, and this might have been a really sacred moment, you know, and I'm still struggling with that one. Anyhow, Lynn.
All I can tell you is that when you made the specific remark about her organizing her plastic utensils, you brought a tear to my eye.
Mm. Yeah. Well.
I've been there and done that, and I had one child do, well, I don't even. Anyway, you're a wonderful man. Keep up the good work. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate the call. Joan in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Joan, thanks for listening to WNYY. What's up?
Hi, this will probably be the last time I'll ever get to talk to you. You have been changed to the 6 to 9 slot here in Ithaca.
Yeah, that's fine.
And I'm at work, and you probably won't even be live then. But I was telling the young lady I spoke to that my daughter and I were getting off at the mall for the exit, and there was a boy standing there with his girlfriend or his wife and a puppy. And they had a sign, hungry, you know, no job, you know, could you help us? Mm-hmm. So Kristen goes, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'll tell you what. We will go over to the grocery store, and I will get that doggy, the puppy, a bag of dog chow.
Mm-hmm.
A good one. And so we got from the store, came back down, got on the main road, got back off the exit, and I handed this kid this bag of dog chow, really good stuff, and he looked at me like, thank you so very much.
Mm.
And he meant it. He wasn't trying to rip me off. He was really sincere. And if this happens to you again, then you know how you felt now? Well, you'll have a chance to reclaim that.
Yep. I hope so. I hope so.
Because you are a good guy, and you taught us. I've learned so much from you over the last 5 years, and I thank you immensely.
Well, thank you, Joan. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening to WNYY, and thank you for your kind words. We'll be back. Anything Goes Friday, 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, it being Anything Goes Friday, we can talk about Ron Paul and the Fed if you want. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here with big news. We're moving. Starting next week, the Tom Hartman Program will be live 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's noon to 3 Pacific Time. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in our chat room. Eddie says, Tom, you're feeling guilt. Like, yeah. But I am not. Please don't think that I'm talking about this on the air because I'm looking for absolution. I mean, I may well be. It's entirely probable, actually. But you don't need to tell me I'm okay or, you know, I did my best or whatever because, you know, I got to work through this stuff, and B, I feel like I really blew it, and so there is that guilt, but I thought that this is, you know, there are larger issues here about our common humanity and how we deal with these things, and I think that's a very interesting frame and context. Anne in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Anne, thanks for calling.
Tom. It's an honor to talk to you, first off.
Thank you.
But regarding the woman, I just wanted to say that, you know, although to you it did feel like you failed some kind of test and, now it's a lesson for you and you'll say, you know what, $6, who cares? I feel great.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think that there's a larger picture, the fact that you have such a large audience of people who hear you every day, and you've brought this issue out for all of us to hear. And so if it was a test, I would say that it's probably a test that you're passing, because you're able to bring this to all of us to take a look at ourselves and just take a look at humanity in general. And I thank you for that.
Well, that's a great reframe. You know, if so, then I'm making lemonade out of that lemon. And I just wish I hadn't eaten, you know, bit into the lemon. You know, I wish I just bought that woman the lunch, and the first time she yelled sir at me, I turned around and said, what can I do? And if it was something crazy, then I could say, I'm sorry, you know, I can't do that. And if it was, will you buy me lunch? I could have said, yeah. But anyhow, Ann, thank you. Go ahead.
Sure.
You were going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say that maybe just a little bit of guilt, you know, helps all of us.
Yep.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Ann. Appreciate the call. Hang on just a second, Gary. I want to share that one other thought that was in the chat room here. This was, where did it go? Oh, yeah, here it is. This is from Eddie. He said, Chris Hedges spoke of acts of deviance. He said, we need to defy our inhibitions and our timidness. And, yeah, I was timid. Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary. What's up?
Hi, Tom. To understand the Bible in its entirety is important because it's balanced. On the one hand, you know Matthew 25, but Jesus also says, you will always have your poor, and you can give to them when you want.
Well, okay, yes and no. He said, you know, I forget her name, she was washing his feet with incense, and one of the disciples said, you know, that's expensive stuff. We should give that money to the poor. And Jesus said, you will always have the poor with you, but you're not always going to have the Messiah with you. So, you know, just let her do her thing. This is special. And then he added, as I recall, it's been a few years, but then he added, this will be a story that will be carried on in the future and will have significance. So, you know, it was an example kind of thing. I get really concerned when people quote Jesus saying, you will have the poor with you always, as a justification to do nothing about the poor. I think that is a complete misinterpretation of him. And again, this is not unique to Christianity, all religions.
Okay. And another example of balance is, you just finished talking about Jesus being a pacifist.
Yeah.
But really, he was in the temple, he kicked over tables, he took a rod, cleared the tables of all the merchandise, and he did that to the money changers.
That's right.
Not the merchants, but the money changers who were misusing dishonest ways, usury, you know, and so we see that's the only time Jesus gets angry, and he has to, because he has to balance out the human nature. He's pacifist, but he also shows that you know you have to have anger sometimes.
Well, there's some debate on who those money changers were, whether that word meant people who were, you know, loaning people money so that they could make contributions to the church, or whether they were people who were selling things that could then be taken as offerings, because typically people gave, you know, live animals as offerings and things. And but you know, again, I would like to keep this out of the frame. Gary, thank you very much for the call. I don't feel like I failed as a Christian, or succeeded, or whatever. I think that this is more of an issue of being a human being, and you know, what would Jesus do is a great question, but what should we all do, I think, is the most important question. Ari in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Ari, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, what I just called to say is you caught it. It's not like it just went over your head, and the fact that it bothers you enough to bring it up, you know, really helps us, because it's almost like a confrontation when, you know, some of these things occur to us in public.
Yeah.
So I just don't think you should beat yourself up at all. I think you did good.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call, Ari. It took, well, anyway, Alice in Los Angeles. Hey, Alice, thanks for listening to Free Talk. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Yeah, you were talking about observed something that spoke to you of hunger, but that was maybe an observation where it was hunger for food, but it could have been hunger for the truth or something like that. So I come from a large family and have family members that have been homeless, so I have a little bit different experience with, you know, some of the things they've told me what they need.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I have an opportunity to be giving to homeless because I'm out in the public a lot and see it, but I don't do it. But one thing that I would do is find out what the resources are for them.
Sure.
And let them know about that. Like you said, by the street.
Yeah.
Thing. So,
there's a homeless shelter. I'm sorry. Finish
up.
I was going to say there's a homeless shelter that I walk by when I walk into work, you know, when my mother's nice, I walk to work. And I've often thought about, you know, just walking in there and saying, you know, how do I contribute to you? And now I'm a little more motivated to do that. So, anyhow.
No, but I figured it out that, you know, the $100 a month that I used to drop off to him, turned out that those $20 bills ended up in other people that were helping the homeless, like he was.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I say, there's, you know, I just wanted to let you know that it wasn't necessarily anything that, you know, you should rack your conscience about.
Okay.
And it's nice of you to share, you know, all this with everybody.
Thank you for the sell.
Well, another thing, too, about the Mormon talk yesterday, I just want to add that in that case there, you know, the little problem that I personally have it with is I always want to talk about the mysticism. And, you know, that's something that doesn't, it's not a comfortable subject. So I tried to get through yesterday to, you know, speak about that. So just for your own sake.
You mean that there is a mystical aspect of Mormonism that you think is good or bad?
No. In whatever religions, you know, that I study, you know, I'm hunger for, you know, the truth. I look for those mystical
I always have too. It's what drew me to Sufism and in Islam. It's what drew me to Meister Eckhart and St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila, you know, in Christianity. And
I've been there with you and everything that you just mentioned, but I wasn't able to go down that path with the Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, that's,
you know, and maybe I just, well, I just wanted to throw that out to you.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a mystical tradition in Mormonism or not. But I think that I think that we're, as humans, all wired for it. So I would be surprised if there isn't some mystical tradition. But as you said, I don't know. Alice, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And let's see here. Dean in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on Bernie Sanders' reasons for the increase in the price of oil. And I think he missed the biggest reason. I happen to be one of these oil speculators on a very minor scale, but I do sometimes buy the price of oil, and I read a lot about it. And the reason that the experts say that it's going up, the overwhelming reason is because of the threat of war, the Americans moving troops and material into the Middle East, and the Israel bellicose nature of their statements. And this is causing the price of oil to go up, which is just another example of our militarism causing problems not only for people in other countries, but here right at home.
Yeah, and apropos of that, now we have the second former director of Mossad. Yesterday I shared with you the story of the an older former director of Mossad, Ephraim Halevi, who came out and said that Mitt Romney's op-ed in the Washington Post a couple of days ago, in which Mitt Romney said that the Iranians have a nuclear bomb program and are racing to build a nuclear bomb. First of all, that contradicts everything that all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies say. And secondly, what this first director yesterday of the Mossad said is this is not a good thing. He said what you're telling the Iranians is you better be quick about it. In other words, you're hurting the process. Now, today, the former director of Mossad, who just retired last year, Deir Meir Dagan, I believe, or Dagan, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, M-E-I-R-D-A-G-A-N, said he believes the Iranian regime is a very rational one, including Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And he said an attack on Iran before you are exploring all other approaches is not the right way. He just retired in January 2011, and he says trying to foment regime change is a smarter tactic. Both these guys are saying that all this chest thumping that's going on by the Republicans for political purposes to try to win the White House or win Senate seats and things like that is not, I mean, they don't specifically call that out. I mean, the first guy actually called out Romney, but the second guy didn't call out Romney. But the point is that there's an interesting piece, and I'm going to have to track down the publication and tell you after the break, but where it's basically this expert is saying we can live with a nuclear Iran, actually. So, Dean, thank you very much for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, and we will be probably checking in with Talk Radio News after the break and continue to take your calls, of course, throughout the day.
Circle of change, the world around you.
Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Martin in Washington, New Jersey. Hey, Martin, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I like the way you always bring out the supposed good things in the Bible, but you know there's a lot of bad things, like Deuteronomy 22, verse 21. A bride found not to be a virgin must be stoned to death.
Sure.
Ezekiel 35:8. God promises to fill the mountains, hills, valleys, and rivers with slain men.
Martin, I'm sorry. Ellen Ratner's on hold from Antarctica. I didn't realize she had gotten through. Ellen, we'll get back to you, Martin. Ellen, welcome.
Well, thank you so much. I'm here in Antarctica. This is actually my last day in Antarctica. I'm going to be going back. I've spent 7 days here almost, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really interesting, I'm with a group called 2041. The treaty in Antarctica ends in 2041. Currently, Antarctica belongs to no one and everyone. The problem is that 70% of the world's fresh water is held in those icebergs, held in those glaciers. If we start melting them and we turn Antarctica into another place that we can drill baby drill, we are up a creek as humanity. And that's, I think, the thing that really has been driven home to me as I've seen so much of this, is I've seen the parts of glaciers break off. Now, that's a normal phenomenon, but it's happening at a very rapid rate. What's fascinating, Tom, is that I am on this 2041 trip with a lot of big oil companies, and the oil companies have these sort of green teams that they have because they now are calling themselves energy companies.
Right.
So these large multinational oil companies are trying to look very green and are trying to say, oh no, we're not just interested in drilling, we're interested in energy. And that has been pretty fascinating for me as well. The other thing that I have learned here is that people, when the Japanese were doing so much whaling, it destroyed a lot of the whale population, even in Antarctica, in the Arctic waters, etc.
Right.
Well, what happens is whale poop actually feeds the plankton, which feed the krill, which feed the penguins, which, you know, which feed then the seals, which feed the whales, etc. And so you can definitely see that there is a huge loop. And anytime we do something as a world to take out one of the species, it's not a good thing.
Let me give you another example of that, Ellen, that you'll love, and you might want to use it sometime. I learned this when I lived in the Pacific Northwest, that when, you know, the salmon spawn in the rivers, and then the bears come down and they eat the salmon. There are trees in the northern forests, particularly the northern rainforests around Washington State and northern Oregon and southern British Columbia, that require micronutrients that are not found on land. They're found in the ocean, iodine and things like that. And and the way that those trees get that is the salmon spawn come up the river, the bears eat the salmons, the bears go out and poop in the woods, and the bear poop provides the micronutrients for the forest that is essential for the survival of that forest. And as those bears have been vanishing in the areas where the salmon streams are vanishing, the forests are dying.
Wow, that's a great example, and I will use it. First of all, if people want to follow what we've been up to, you can go to 2041.com because they really are trying to extend that treaty. And what's interesting to me is that the United States has just kind of ho-hum. We're not that interested. Yes, we have a few research facilities down here in Antarctica, but we don't seem to be pushing that treaty at the rate we should be.
So the treaty would be to extend the absolutely neutral and independent status of Antarctica beyond 2041?
That's exactly right. And right now, there are countries, be it China, Russia, a little bit the United States, Argentina, Chile, et cetera, that are saying, well, if 2041 ends, so they will have a claim here.
Well, and I would think any of the Southern Hemisphere countries, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Chile, Argentina, you mentioned, Brazil, I would think that all of them are thinking, hey, this is, you know, the same way that the Northern Hemisphere countries are now at a low level fighting over the Arctic.
Right, exactly. And so I think it's really important to try and preserve what we have here. The other fascinating thing, which I'm sure you know, is that they're able to tell when these icebergs break away how old this ice really is, because they can tell by the flora and fauna as they.
They can also measure the radioisotopes or the oxygen and, or the gases in it. And
that's right. Yeah. Exactly. And so we know that what's happening in terms of global warming isn't pretty. And I have to tell you, I was on one of my conservative stations this morning, and all they would say to me is, well, just tell us about the penguins. We're not interested in your global warming BS. Well, I got news for them. There is such a thing.
Yeah. And you're seeing it down there in Antarctica right now.
You can't miss it. I think you and Louise need a trip down here.
Yeah, I would love to. We were we actually had one booked years ago, and that was the year that my dad was diagnosed with cancer, and we blew it off and never got back to it. Ellen, what are the? You said that you're on this expedition to Antarctica. There's a bunch of oil industry people with you. How do they react to this global warming issue?
Well, it's interesting because I said to one of them from one of the big oil companies, I said, well. They said, well, we have this sort of small group thing. What are really important to you? And I said, what's important to me is that we get off of fossil fuels. And they said to me, oh, well, that's never going to happen. I said, but you're involved in one of the green pieces of your company. Well, yes, we're looking for alternative forms of energy, but we know that we'll never be without fossil fuels. Really? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What's interesting is Robert Swan, who's leading this, has actually set up a scientific outpost in Antarctica, and they completely do everything by wind energy and other geothermal, those other kinds of energies that they possibly can harness, and they run their whole operation that way. It's the first place in Antarctica to do that.
You know, I'll bet if you could hop in a time machine and go back, you know, 500, 800 years to northern England and talk to a village where every house is heated by peat bog. You know, they cut up these 10,000-year-old peat bogs and bricks and burn them and say, someday you're not going to use peat bog to heat your house. They'd look at you like you were crazy, right? It's like people don't, you know, or buggy whip manufacturers. Someday you're not going to be needed, you know, those buggy whips. And,
it's amazing. Exactly, and I think that what they're also trying to impress on us is how important the oceans and the ice is to maintaining human life.
There you go. Ellen Ratner in Antarctica, live with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by her new book, Self-Empowerment. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. Martin in Washington, New Jersey. Martin, I cut you off in mid-sentence because Ellen had called in from Antarctica. My apologies. If I may preface before I throw it back to you, you were going through all the horrible things in the Bible. I can give you a much longer list, and in fact, I would guess that you probably haven't been listening to the show for a long time, because back when the gay marriage debates were really going hot and heavy, I was constantly getting on people from the Family Research Council and the Republican Party and other right-wingers, and they would say, this isn't in the Bible. This, you know, the Bible says that homosexuality is a sin. And I would say to them, oh, so you don't eat shellfish, because it's in the same part of Deuteronomy. Oh, so you would kill your child if he talked back to you. And, you know, they're shocked speechless, you know, more often than not. Or they'll say, oh, well, that was the Old Testament. And then I say, well, you're quoting the Old Testament. There's no place in the New Testament where Jesus condemns homosexuality. And then, you know, they've got nothing. So I'm with you that there's a lot of awful stuff in the Bible. In fact, probably the awfulest stuff in the Bible is the entire book of Joshua, where God repeatedly tells Joshua to go into cities and murder everybody. And you know, cut open the bellies of pregnant women and kill the dogs. And I mean, it just on and on and on. I acknowledge all that. I'm not an evangelist. I'm not trying to convert anybody to any religion or say that any religion is uniquely wonderful. Now that I've said my piece, back to you.
And first of all, it's no problem that you interrupted me. That's fine. I like to hear Ellen Ratner. I have been listening to you since practically day one you were on the air.
My apologies.
No, not at all. I love your show. First of all, I don't even think this creature named Jesus ever existed, because he's just a rehashing of the story of Ishtar. Mm-hmm. Anybody who studies comparative religion would understand that.
And Ishtar is the rehashing of a story older than that. I mean, there's three or four of them that go all the way back to
Osiris is another one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, there's a lot of them.
That doesn't mean that those people didn't exist, and, you know, it could be that...
These are written decades, if not centuries later.
Oh, millennia. Millennia. Exactly. But, my, you know, what I'm suggesting is that there may be a reason why we are drawn to archetypal notions, that you know, that this is archetypal. You'll find the Jesus story or variations on it in many tribes, in other religions, in ancient times. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But is that because one borrowed from the other, or is that because that archetype is part of the way that we're wired? You know, if you've been listening for the 9 years I've been on the air, you've heard me probably 100 times tell the story of the red deer, you know, how animals behave democratically. They all vote you know, those kind of things. I mean, there's stuff that's wired into our DNA. And could it be that acknowledging... Go ahead.
Yeah, I believe that, you know, the best social system is the ant kingdom. If you... you know, have their social system. They have everybody working together for the common good.
Yeah, and that's and they do, and they're small d democratic, and as are virtually all sentient life forms. In fact, even now that they know how to measure pheromones that are being emitted by trees and things, they find that, you know, if you're cutting a tree, that tree is blowing out chemicals that to all the trees around it sound like ah. You know, and they will actually alter their skin surfaces, their leaf surfaces, you know, on the assumption that one of them is under attack, thinking that maybe it's bugs coming or maybe it's, you know, bacteria coming or whatever. So,
yeah, isn't evolution beautiful?
It is. I mean, nature is so extraordinary that I find, you know, my deepest solace, my deepest mystical moments are out in nature. And I think that again, you know, whether Saint Francis or I give you know the long list, all the mystics in history and all the religions, you know, found a lot of their juice by communing with nature. As did Thomas Jefferson, who I believe mm-hmm. was a mystic. Anyhow, Martin, I want to let other people in here on this conversation. Thank you so much for the call, Hollis in Leonard, Texas. Hey, Hollis, what's up?
Oh, good morning. Good afternoon, Tom.
Thank you.
It's nice here. I haven't mowed since 2007, so there's young trees growing on the 35 acres.
That's great.
And, you know, Tom, when you get down to it, God never desired to sacrifice. And we, you know, look there, Christ reiterates Hosea 6:6. In 9:13 of Matthew and 9:13, meaning in 12:7, Matthew, and says, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. And yeah. He says in this Matthew 12:7, if you'd known what it meant, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless.
Yeah. Hollis, you're absolutely right. But I don't want to turn this into a discussion of theology. Thank you very much for the call. It's not so much that I don't want to turn into a conversation about theology, it's that I don't want to debate theology. Bob in Farmington, Missouri. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Some of us would say that woman was probably sent by the coyote to teach.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that.
It sounds like you've really learned that, you know what I mean? You learned that we should help each other, you know what I mean? If you can help somebody, you help them.
Yeah.
That really kind of that simple.
That's why I said the two moments, and these are, you know, I'm sharing this story in for a whole bunch of obviously complex and some very simplistic, you know, I feel guilty kind of reasons, but there are moments in your life where things happen that you remember for the rest of your life, and you know it at the time because of how deeply they touch you. And how clearly you see it. It's like all of a sudden everything's crystal clear in a photograph. Every sound is captured. I mean, that was what happened to me yesterday. In that moment when I heard that voice or heard myself saying, I was hungry and you did not feed me. and just the feeling that of horror, frankly, that just went through me. And then as I was, you know, looking at her later, and I thought, you know, she's a shaman. She's a holy person. And which, you know, for probably a lot of my listeners and viewers is a real stretch, but I think that that's the case. And I would agree with you that, you know, in the worldview of many Native Americans, the coyote visited me. In fact, she might have been or whatever, you know, was sent by.
Yeah. I'm going to do something I always tell people that they shouldn't do. I'm going to tell the truth here. I'm Wiccan.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that was talking about Jesus a few minutes ago, one of the good things about being Wiccan is sometimes you get to meet spirits. And I've met Jesus. He's a wonderful spirit. He's love.
That's great. That's great.
Just so you all know.
Okay. Bob, thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Mel in Eugene, Oregon. We have a minute to the break, Mel. It's all yours.
Tom, I wanted to jump out of the theological area of Judeo-Christian concepts and charity and go back a few thousand years into a primitive culture. I read a story about how the Plains Indians, when they would have a large buffalo kill, the successful hunters would be dressing their kill out, and the widows and orphans and the handicapped would roam through these fields, and they would stop by the hunters and wait to be given, you know, something that they needed to eat through the winter. And these men, these hunters who were successful, they would generally cut out portions of the meat that they weren't going to give to their family, and they would donate them mm-hmm. to the less fortunate.
Yeah.
These men who did this were, you know, considered to be gracious and great people,
right.
And those that didn't got the name of butchers with your heads down.
Yeah,
and I believe that I'd like to transpose into this new election we got going, and saying that these peddlers of pink slime that you're mentioning, the mm-hmm. Republican candidates for president,
sure.
are essentially butchers with their heads down.
Brilliant. And Mel, the culture that you're talking about, the cultures that you're talking about are often referred to as potlatch cultures, and you get status by giving things away in those kinds of cultures.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And thank you for the call. And it's an interesting turn the conversation has taken. Is coyote about?
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. Lisa in Westminster, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Lisa, what's up?
Hey, Tom, on the panhandling issue, I hope you're not assuming we have all these terrific programs to cover every legitimate need of the poor, because we don't.
I know.
Even the food banks. Yeah, where I live, you can go three weeks in a row, and they give you so much stuff, you need a car to move it, then that's it. Salvation Army, you can go once every 3 months.
Yep.
And then there's other needs. People need bus passes. They need to do their laundry. They need a toothpick. There's just so many legitimate needs. And if somebody's down
agree.
On their luck, they should be able to ask for a hand. It's not all going to go for booze. And if nobody gives to people who panhandle, who can't find a program to cover their needs, then you'll probably see more theft and mugging. And we don't want that.
Yep.
We need better assistance.
I completely agree. And I think that I agree with Franklin Roosevelt that the best welfare program is a job, and that I believe that the government should be the employer of last resort. We should resurrect the CCC and the WPA tomorrow morning and put 10 or 15 million people back to work. And those people who aren't capable of working, whether it's by virtue of physical illness or mental illness, those people should be absolutely taken care of by and cared for by all of us. And that is the obligation that we have as fellow human beings, as citizens of this country. And yes, I absolutely agree. And that's the real challenge that I think everybody faces. And it's fascinating to me to see the feedback. You know, I've actually gotten a few people saying to me in chat or in email or on our message board, you know, how dare you think that you can decide this person's worthy of taking your charity because they sell street scents, but this person isn't because they haven't been vetted by somebody. And you're right. You know, it's like at a certain point, we all have to figure out how we're going to interact with each other, and which panhandler do you give the money to, and why, and does it even matter if they use it to buy a bottle of wine? I mean, there's part of me that says, you know, if that's their life's path and they're not going to change it, then you know, God bless them, you know.
How do you know that your contribution went to the wine anyway? Even somebody who's addicted to it.
Exactly right. You're exactly right. Winos need to eat too. You're exactly right. And these are the big issues that we as a country have not struggled with since Lyndon Johnson was president and we had the Great Society. And when we were in a bubble economy in the late 90s, and the Republicans said, oh, you know, we're gonna end welfare as we know it. We're gonna turn the welfare programs into 4-year time limited, got to have a job at the end of 4 years, everything falls off, you get nothing programs. And Bill Clinton proclaimed the end of welfare as we know it. And it seemed like a good thing at the time because we didn't have such a crisis of homelessness and poverty in the United States because the economy was just rip roaring red hot. Now it's not. Now we're in a recession that is as bad as anything we've seen since the Great Depression. And those programs, those social safety net programs that were put in place by Lyndon Johnson that cut poverty in half in the 1960s, those programs are shredded. And we need to fix those programs. And we all as individuals need to be confronting the hunger around us and the struggles around us. I'm absolutely with you. And I don't hold myself out as any kind of example of how we should be doing it or the decisions we should be making. And in fact, as I said earlier, I feel that I failed. And so, Lisa, thank you for your call. Thank you for your comments. Joe in Loxahatchee, Florida.
Loxahatchee.
Hey, Joe, what's up?
Well, you're doing very wonderful work, Tom. That's number one.
I'm doing my best.
I have a quick question and a comment.
Mm-hmm.
What is fracking doing to our crops?
I don't know. It's to the extent that a large percentage of our crops depend on irrigation, and the irrigation is drawn out of aquifers, out of groundwater, and that the groundwater could be contaminated by the fracking, we might be recycling toxic, poisonous chemicals into the roots of our food supply. But right. Beyond that, I don't know of any immediate consequence. Do you?
Well, it's poisonous. Is good. You know, they're bent on destroying our environment.
Yeah, poison in the ground is poison in the ground. It's not a good thing.
Right. And the comment that I'd like to make is I used to have a former girlfriend that was misdiagnosed as bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
And because her meds never worked properly, she kept on digging and found out through a T3 and T4 blood test by a competent endocrinologist that her thyroid is malfunctioning.
Mm-hmm. Which is a very, very common problem in the United States, particularly for people born after the 1950s when we had the above-ground atomic tests. Levothyroid or levothyroxine or whatever it is, the supplement that is given to people for low thyroid function is mm-hmm. And I know this because members of my family are taking it, is the most commonly prescribed drug in the United States, and it's mostly women. And although there's a fair number of men who have thyroid disorders as well, and you're absolutely right. And I think, frankly, that we're seeing this epidemic of particularly women. You know, when they give birth, the fetus is sucking iodine out of their thyroid, so they have an added, you know, out of their body, and the thyroid is storing it, so they have an added demand on their body, which is why I think it's more women. But that I think that what we're seeing is this epidemic, millions of people with thyroid disorders in the United States, is the consequence of the we're paying the penance of the above ground nuclear tests, and perhaps even routine releases of nuclear material from the 104 nuclear plants we have in the United States.
Yeah, it's interesting that she's downriver from the Indian Point nuclear power plant in the Hudson River.
Yeah, bingo. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. We will be back right after this. 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And coming up next, the good, the bad, and the very, very new vocabulary word ugly. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very snollagosterously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good, New York Assemblywoman Teresa Sayward. Sayward, a Republican, told a New York political television program yesterday that she does not support her party's candidates for president because of their stances on women. Similarly, she told the program that the current Republican candidates for president would take women back decades. She went on to say, quote, "It's disheartening for me to see our party move away from what it was always about, and that is to stay out of people's lives," end quote. Nice to finally see a Republican standing up to the party and that party's ongoing war on women. Hopefully Ms. Sayward can influence more of her colleagues to do the same thing. The bad. Senator James Inhofe. In an interview with the Voice of Christian Youth America, Inhofe argued that global warming is a hoax because God said it wasn't possible. Inhofe said that only God can change the climate and that the notion that man-made pollution could affect the environment is ridiculous. Inhofe went on to say, "God's still up there. The arrogance of people to think that we, human beings, would be able to change what he is doing in the climate is to me outrageous." Right. The only thing outrageous here is that Inhofe has received over $1 million from Big Oil. So it should come as no surprise that he's part of the global warming-denying cult. And the very, very ugly, Sarah Palin. In an interview with Fox So-Called News yesterday, Palin suggested that President Obama wants to return America back to the days before the Civil War, her phrase. She said, quote, "What Barack Obama seems to want to do is to go back to those days, back to before those days, when we were in different classes based on income, based on color of skin," end quote. Eh? President Obama is fighting for greater equality among Americans. Not quite sure how that means he wants a separation of classes in America. Similarly, he's the first African-American president our nation's ever had. And as a result, has made great strides for the African-American community. Yet again, Sarah Palin using vitriolic rhetoric to spread misinformation to the American public. And that is very, very ugly. Amazing. Jackie in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Jackie. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you so much for bringing up your moral dilemma yesterday that you had. I think it's so important.
I called it my existential crisis. <It's>,
I think that we all have... these things happen to us, and I think it's really important to remember that it's the ones that we don't stand up for, the ones that we don't help, those are the ones that remain with us, and I think that's really important.
Yeah.
That those are the ones that remain with us, so that we can
which should tell us something about
them.
Yeah, it should tell us something about who we really are deep inside.
Right, because all the ones that we do help, those are the forgettable ones. You know, it's these other ones. The other thing I wanted to bring up is I know there's been some people that have brought up stuff about giving change or whatever. But my take is always, you know, if someone asks me for money or whatever, I have to go ahead and
give it to them.
Yeah, I have to give it to them because, you know, if I don't give it to them, then it's on me. If they're lying to me or whatever, or they're going to go out and buy a bottle of wine, that's on them.
Yeah.
If I don't help and they really need it, then it falls on me.
There are times, though, Jackie, and it's not so much in the United States. You don't see this so much, but I've been in countries where literally if you pull a dollar or a rupee or a whatever the local currency may be out of your pocket and give it to one person, you will be mobbed. You will be followed down the street. You wherever you go, You'll never be able to walk out of that hotel again without having 20, 30, 40 people following you, screaming at you. It is, and then it becomes a real existential crisis. It's like, what do I do with this, you know? And I guess I'm just saying that. There's no therefore. So anyhow, Jackie, thank you for the call. Let me get some more calls in here, okay? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Yes, Tom. Woo! Congratulations for whatever. It's a beautiful day.
It
well,
is.
I would like to say this. The woman is the most important part of human life. And we miss it so much when we read the Bible that's been given to us through corruption of religion, obviously. But the word, we got to have this spirituality and this respect for an idea of Almighty God. Now, listen to this real quick, my brother. This is so important that sorrow, the Bible says that the woman, everybody thinks that the woman was cursed. But the woman wasn't cursed. And the woman represents, first of all, a woman is not female, biological. The word woman is a definition which means, if you look it up in a dictionary, in a good collegiate dictionary, the word woman means somewhat a unique character of the female human being. Mm-hmm. Something unique about woman is not... It's not physical female. You don't have women, cows, and women, donkeys. But anyway,
so your point, Michael.
I get this out. Okay, I'm going to get to my point. My point here also is that, first of all, the woman was given a lesson. When everybody reads that part in Genesis where it says to the woman, Almighty God said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and conception and pain. You will bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband. That actually is saying, first of all, the word sorrow means a distress, a pain that's caused by something being held back. So God will greatly hold things back, just like we do a child of some sort that does it wrong. We hold things back. So to the woman, he said, I'm going to hold some things back. I'm going to greatly hold back what? Your conception.
Yeah.
Your conception.
So, Michael, your point?
Or did you
just wanted to preach about this?
No, I'm not going to preach. I'm just going to say this, that the woman is the protection of the mind, which is the man. In a good collegiate dictionary, the word man means mind that's able to reason well and communicate well. The woman is the protection of the word of God.
Okay, got it. Thank you, Michael. Terry, in listening on K-Talk, I'm assuming in L.A., Terry.
Hi. How you doing, Tom?
Fine. What's up?
Good to talk. I'm really enjoying the spirituality on the show today. I mean, I think it's really been wonderful to talk about these kind of things. I think that's what's most important with people is what they do with their own life and their own, you know, will. And it's interesting that people can get involved in different faiths. I think sometimes the faiths take away the responsibility for the individual. And because I'm personally a recovering Catholic, and I know one thing that made a big difference to me was studying history and finding out what the popes were up to sometimes, because we're always taught they're so infallible and so perfect and all of this, and they were fairly evil creatures at times, you know. And so it makes you question where all this comes from. And when you think about the Mormon Church, I don't know if you've read Krakauer, Under the Banner of Heaven. Have you read that book?
I've had that recommended to me by three or four people. I've been writing a book for the last year, and so virtually all of my writing has been research for that book. And so I haven't been able to do any recreational reading, but that's on my list.
It's an amazing resource. It's got, and the thing that was in there, he's very reporter-like about it, you know, but it becomes clear that Joseph Smith, it appears that he sort of was someone who sort of made things up as he went along, and it's, you know, it just makes you question the whole situation, and it's interesting that the people who are in charge of the religion really don't want the people in the religion to know all of those things necessarily. And yesterday there was some confusion with people were saying that when Joseph Smith appeared in North America, that he wiped out the Native American population.
No, when Jesus appeared in North America.
Appeared to Joseph. Yeah, well, I think that confusion might be coming from the fact that, you know, they have the white undergarment, you know, to try to name it, you know, respectfully, that they're all supposed to wear.
Yeah,
and
the magic
idea
underwear.
Is that when... Magic underwear, okay. And when Jesus, when he comes back to earth, if you're not wearing your undergarment, what's going to happen? The angels are going to rip the clothes off of everyone. And everyone who's naked will be left on earth to perish, and those wearing the white undergarment will be lifted up off the earth and witness the perishing of everyone else. And
really?
And then the Lord back down. Yeah, so that might be where that's coming from, the wiping out everybody.
That's interesting. Because, you know where the white undergarments, where the white underwear, where apparently Joseph Smith got that idea was from the Masons. Masons wear secret underwear, too. Only they only wear secret underwear into the temple.
Oh, okay. Well, you're supposed to have it on every second. And, like, I know in the FLDS, the really fundamentalist,
right,
you know, branch, some people won't even take it off when they shower. They take off half of it, shower half their body, then put on the clean garment, then take off the other half, clean the other. And so it's not a very clean situation either for a lot of them.
And I'll bet a lot of this goes back to the sissis, I think is how it's pronounced, the garment that you'll see Hasidic Jews wear, which is specified in Deuteronomy. It's an undergarment under the shirt and with long threads coming out the side.
Oh, the tassels.
The tassels.
Uh-huh.
And
right, yeah.
And now that is in the Bible. I mean, that's biblical, right? It's in the
mm-hmm.
And I'll bet that out of that came the Masons and came the Mormons. Well, I don't know. I'm purely speculating here now, which is probably a dangerous thing to do about somebody else's religion.
Ideas from each other, though. Joseph Smith was a very crafty individual, and he was. I don't want to just disparage a religion, but honestly, he sounded more like a snake oil salesman.
Well,
than,
you know, every you religion know. Has its snake oil salesman. every religion does it. Go read the Vedas. Read the story of Hanuman. And, I mean, he wasn't the hustler so much, but there certainly were a lot of them in there. And anyhow, Terry, thank you very much for the call. And maybe Joseph Smith was a hustler. I don't think that matters today. He's long gone. We'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything goes Friday. Your calls right after this, 45 minutes past the hour.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Julie Lulley, our writer-researcher Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager Ron Hartenbaum at WID, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global on commercial stations, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial stations, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country. Thanks to Don Rojas, Dennis Trunov, all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture. To our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, Ellen Ratner, to Victoria Jones, everyone at Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Chris, listening on WHMP in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Listen, that shaman that you talked about, she got you, man.
Yeah.
What she gave you was the gift of a thought, you know, a pause in your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just say that I say that because I'm actually kind of a reluctant shaman myself, because of a brain trauma when I was younger. I had cerebral meningitis, and it basically, I don't know, kind of did this synesthesia or something like that.
Synesthesia,
where
you can taste
anyway,
smells.
Let me tell you this quick.
Yeah.
Let me tell you this quick story. I was in New York City, and this big, scary homeless guy had just had it. And he came up to me in this park, and he says, "If you don't give me money, man, I am really going to hurt you." And what I said to him is, I said, "There you are." I go, "I dreamed about you last night." And it stopped him in his tracks.
Hmm.
I mean, absolutely stopped him in his tracks. And I go, "Sit down. Talk to me for a sec." You know, and I go, "You know, what's your story?" And so, you know, in that, I didn't have any money to give him, but in that way, I had an ear to give him.
Yeah.
You know, and which I think is kind of equally important. We have to recognize each other's humanity no matter what situation that people are in.
Chris, thank you, my brother, for your teaching.
Oh, that's really nice of you to say. Thank you for your teaching.
It is heartfelt. I said in the chat room a little while ago, I think, you know, Coyote keeps calling into the show. I keep learning. Chris, thank you very much. I'm going to move along.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. It's remarkable. Wayne in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Wayne, thanks for listening to KPOJ. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Back in the early 60s, before Medicare, before Medicaid, I worked in a state mental hospital, and I've heard you mention in the past, you know, mental hospitals and how horrible they are, you know, made little offhand remarks.
Usually my references are to how Reagan shut most of them down in the 80s, and yeah, as a consequence of that, suddenly we had homeless people that we had never seen before because people yeah, who well, needed me, help weren't getting it, and then they were living on yeah, the streets.
Let me describe this one just real quickly to sure, offset some of these horrible ideas of yeah, snake pits and such. This one had 6,400 patients in it. The vast majority of them were Alzheimer's patients because we didn't have nursing homes in those days because it was pre-Medicare, pre-Medicaid. Mm-hmm. So when people got dementia, they went to the state hospital.
Right.
The rest of the people, there were some drug addicts because we had on-demand residential 90-day drug treatment.
Mm-hmm.
On demand. You walk in and you ask for drug treatment, you get 90 days.
Wow.
We had on demand mental health care. The vast majority of mental health patients in there were not committed. They were there voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
They got full medical care. We were doing open heart surgeries on Down syndrome babies because parents would commit their babies to the state mental hospital with their Down syndrome, and Down syndrome have a lot of heart defects.
Hmm.
And so we would do the heart repairs there, and then they'd take them home afterwards and uncommit them.
Mm-hmm.
But they would commit them just for the time it took to get their open heart surgeries
wow,
done. And I worked on the chest surgery unit there, but we had a neurological unit. We had a diabetic unit. If you're mentally ill and had diabetes, you were housed on a diabetic unit where the entire staff, and I was on the low end of the staff scale, the absolute bottom, and I was the equivalent of an LPN.
Mm-hmm.
We had a one-year training course that was equivalent to an LPN training course, and that was the lowest paid person on the entire staff.
What state was this in?
California.
Yeah, and that was the first state.
This was
that,
under Jerry Brown.
Yeah. Jerry Brown, the senior, you mean?
Yeah, or Pat Brown.
Pat Brown, yeah. Jerry Brown's yeah, dad, yeah.
Right. And we didn't, you know, and we weren't over-medicating people because in those, we didn't have
In the 60s, there weren't that many good meds, actually.
Well, they had some.
Basically, barbiturates.
We used them on the people that they worked best on because all we had were the samples sent to us by the drug companies.
Uh-huh.
And so we just used them on the people that they absolutely worked best on and created the best.
And the
life
lack
for
of these good programs for people who are struggling with mental illness, which is, you know, should be considered by our society no different than diabetes or
right,
or you know high blood pressure. I mean, it's a part of the body is not working right. This is another one of the horrible legacies of the Reagan presidency, is
absolutely,
the destruction of a national system of state mental hospitals that provided for people who actually needed the services and provided quite well. And
right,
and Wayne, thank you for sharing your story with us.
You bet.
I appreciate
Thanks,
it. And it's hopefully it somebody out there is hearing it who can do something about it. So. Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us this week. And coming up on Monday, I'm going to be challenging William Yeatman of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, latest battle on the Keystone XL pipeline, and find out how libertarians are justifying that little eminent domain thing. And don't forget, and in your calls in the news, of course, and don't forget, democracy begins when you get active. Show up. Occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.